We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Hello, Dolly. This is Louis. Dolly, it's so nice to have you back where you belong. You looking swell, Dolly. I can tell, Dolly. You still growing, you still going strong. I feel the room swaying while the band's playing one of our old favorite songs from way back when. So take a rap, fellas. Find an empty lap, fellas. Dolly, never go away again.
Morning. This is Focus 580, hour number two of the show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. And that was Louis Armstrong. And I expect probably for a lot of the people who are listening this morning, you don't need me to tell you that. And probably his is one of the most recognizable voices of the 20th century. In this part of Focus, we'll be talking about the life and music of Louis Armstrong. And our guest is Terry Teachout. He's a drama critic of the Wall Street Journal, chief culture critic of Commentary, and is the author of a newly published biography of Armstrong. The title of the book is Pops, which was what he was called by his friends. The book is now just out, published by Houghton Mifflin. And for people who are jazz fans, maybe even if you're not, you'd find a lot of good stuff in there in that book. And I think what will happen after you read the book is that if you weren't a fan, you might well be one, and you'd want to go out and listen to music. We'll play some here this morning. This is, we don't usually play a lot of music, but with a program like this, well, you just got to. Our guest this morning says that Louis Armstrong was one of the first great jazz soloists, but was also a very influential singer, and that, he says, is a pretty rare combination. No less important, he says, was the warmth of Armstrong's personality, and he says that as much as anything else, it was that that made him a star, and the fact that he became a star, that played a crucial role in popularizing jazz. As we talk this morning with Terry Teachout, questions are certainly welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So at any point, pick up the telephone and give us a call, and we'd be happy to have you join the conversation. Well, Terry Teachout, hello.
Hey, it's good to be here.
Well, thanks very much for joining us. We certainly appreciate you doing that. The reason that I played that particular song here just to get us started was in part because I think for a lot of people, that's the Louis Armstrong they know, Louis Armstrong they know. But also for you, that was your introduction to Louis Armstrong.
Yes, it sure was. In 1964, I was 8 years old, and my mother told me to come into the living room. It was a Sunday night. The television was on to the Ed Sullivan Show. She said there was something she wanted me to see, and it was Louis Armstrong singing Hello, Dolly. That is my earliest memory of him and of seeing jazz, and the result, many years later, was that I ended up writing this book.
Well, and I would expect for someone of your age at that time, Louis Armstrong would not be on your big hit parade, I guess. At the time when you saw him, you heard him, did you think to yourself, this is really great?
Yes, I did. Well, you don't have much of a hit parade when you're 8 years old, I don't think. But he made an immediate impression on me, the same way I think he does on most people who see and hear him for the first time. Of course, I didn't understand what I was hearing. What I responded to was that personality reaching through the television screen, really, and touching me, as it has millions of people all over the world.
And that's, I think, maybe almost a little bit to his detriment. His powerful stage presence and his personality perhaps almost overshadowed his musicianship.
Well, it's a two-sided coin. On the one hand, yes, it does, in a way, get in the way of perceiving Armstrong as a musician. On the other hand, it brings him to people who might not otherwise have known about him, because you have to recognize that his appeal is dual. He is an artist, he is an entertainer. They are both intrinsic to Armstrong's art and his personality. You can't have one without the other, and you wouldn't want one without the other.
Mm-hmm. I think it also, you have to continue to keep in mind this, particularly for a performer of his era who started when he did, the balance of art and entertainment was very important. And he came out of a time when you were there to put on a show, and perhaps unlike maybe the jazz musicians of the next generation, who were sometimes you got the idea they were playing for themselves and they didn't even care if there was anybody else there. He was very conscious of the fact that he was putting on a show.
Yes. Remember, born in 1901, in the age of vaudeville and the age of minstrel shows, his early idols included not only fellow musicians like King Oliver, but dancers like Bojangles Robinson, vaudeville comedians like Bert Williams. They're all part of the mix. They're all part of what made him what he became.
And something else that emerges here, you were fortunate that you had access to some material that other writers, and certainly there are other books about Armstrong, other writers didn't have.
Yes, it was an extraordinary stroke of good timing. Armstrong was one of the first people to own a tape recorder. He bought it in 1947 when commercial tape recorders were new. He bought it to tape his shows so that he could listen to them and perfect them. He was a very self-aware musician. But he also began to use it simply to tape his life. The first thing he did was tape off his record collection so he could take it on the road. You know, he played for 300 nights a year, and he wanted his records with him. Then he started using the recorder simply to tape dinner table conversations, to tape idle chat in the dressing room after a show. He would tape himself in his hotel room, all manner of things. And he saved the tapes. At the end of his life, there were 650 reels of tape preserved in his attic. They were ultimately found their way to the Armstrong Archives at Queens College. They were transferred to compact disc. I was the first biographer to come along after they became available.
And I think, is it the case that, in fact, for some time people knew about this material but hadn't spent a lot of time going through it because they suspected that, in fact, because audio tape doesn't age well, that it might not even be playable?
That's exactly right. Everybody knew about the tapes. I mean, their existence was very well known. But when you keep 650 reels of oxide tape in an attic in Queens, you assume the chances are that you're going to have flaking, that the reels are ultimately going to become unplayable. Didn't happen. They were almost all in perfect condition. And when they were digitally transferred by the Armstrong Archive, that meant that forever after, everyone would have access to them.
Yeah. I'm sure that there are a lot of people who would say on their resume was that they were born into hard times and came up rough. But, man, you can't – it'd be hard to find somebody who came up too much rougher than Armstrong.
Yeah, he was born at the very bottom of the ladder. in a neighborhood of New Orleans that back then was known as the Battleground, and with good reason. It was a neighborhood of pimps and whores and thieves and honest, decent people who were doing their best to stay afloat in the midst of all this. His mother was a part-time prostitute. His father deserted the family on the day he was born. They didn't have anything except a mother who was absolutely determined to do the best she could for her boy, and who implanted in him a work ethic, a sense of responsibility that he retained the whole of his life.
He, and I think for a lot of people, think of him perhaps almost as a vocalist first and a trumpet player second. I think it's interesting that, in fact, when he was a boy, the instrument he started out with was the voice.
That's right. He started out as a singer. He put together something a little like a hip barbershop quartet of kids his age who walked the streets of Storyville, the red light district of New Orleans, and sang for pennies, which in 1908, 1909 was quite a big deal to come home with a hat full of pennies from singing. Armstrong, when asked about his singing and playing, said, "I just played the way I sang." And it's true. The two sides of his musical utterances, they both stem from the same root.
And how did a horn first come into his hands?
Well, the junk shop peddlers who would go around New Orleans with wagons would play on tin horns, and he loved the sound of that. And he was working for a family of peddlers, Lithuanian Jews, the Karnowskis, who had taken him under their wing, and they advanced him the money to buy a used cornet. He played around with it, but he didn't really play it seriously until one New Year's Eve, when he got caught firing off a pistol full of blanks and got arrested and sent to a reform school, basically, for black children in New Orleans. It was called the Colored Waifs Home. It was run like a military school. It wasn't one of those reform schools where all you learn is bad habits. And it had a brass band. And Armstrong spent a year and a half there receiving musical instruction. And as he said, many years later, that was where he and music got married.
Yeah. So it started out, he started out teaching himself to play, but then he did go on and have some formal instruction.
Yeah, I mean, serious instruction. He learned how to read music, not fluently at that point, but the experiences he had later on made him actually a very schooled musician. He read and wrote music. There are lots of musical manuscripts of his surviving. The main consequence of not having had the best possible training was that he had lip problems that arose from the fact that he didn't have an ideal embouchure. That's the technical term for the way you put the mouthpiece of a brass instrument against your mouth. Yeah. It put too much strain on his lips, and he had split lips starting very early and at intervals throughout his life.
Yeah, apparently that was a really serious problem, particularly later in his life?
Well, it got to be a serious problem starting in the 30s. Yeah. He had a run of split lips, climaxing with a disastrous performance on stage in Europe, and he did not play the horn again for more than a year after that.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Terry Teachout. He's a drama critic of the Wall Street Journal. He is the author of a book on H.L. Mencken and books both on Mencken and George Balanchine. Interesting trio here, Balanchine, Mencken, and his newest is a biography of Louis Armstrong. The title of the book is Pops. It's just recently out. It's published by Houghton Mifflin. And questions from people listening certainly are welcome. And we got somebody here who'd like to join in, so we'll do that. Talk with the listener in Champaign in line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Just a quick comment. There's a in the current issue of the New Yorker, there's an excellent long piece about Mr. Teachout's book. It's very well done.
Well, yes, indeed. I've read it, and it's there in the magazine, so people can check it out about your book and about Armstrong. I don't know, anything you want to say about the piece?
Well, it was very flattering to have four pages devoted to the two of us, so to speak, in the New Yorker. We've gotten a lot of coverage for this book, and it took us by surprise. Houghton Mifflin didn't expect this kind of response. I didn't expect it. I'm out here on the road touring for the book now. I'm actually speaking to you from New Orleans. And it seems that every day new reviews of this book roll in, and they're all favorable.
Hmm.
Quite an experience.
Well, I guess that invites the question, why would you think that at this point there would be such And no doubt I don't know if it's the way people feel about you, or it's more likely maybe the way people feel about Armstrong.
I think it's the latter, really. I mean, if I do say so myself, I think it's a good book. But Armstrong built up in his lifetime a reservoir of goodwill that has yet to be dispelled. He is mm-hmm. still remembered very vividly. And I'll tell you something, everywhere I go to speak about this book, I always take questions afterwards, there are always people who knew him. Most of them are simply fans who came backstage after a show, ended up going to dinner with Louis Armstrong, and were friends with him for the rest of their lives. He was that kind of man.
Yeah. Well, I want to play some more music here. And at the beginning, I played Hello, Dolly for a couple of reasons that I explained. And I'm sure that a lot of people, when they think of Louis Armstrong, they'll think of that. Or maybe they will know the song Wonderful World, it seems to never die. But what I want to do here is play an early recording, one that I think he's very well known for. And this is West End Blues, and this is Louis Armstrong and the Hot Five. This was recorded in 1927. Maybe just before we play it, I don't know if there's something first you want to say to kind of set it up.
I would simply say this is the key recording in Armstrong's early career. It is regarded as one of the half dozen most important, most significant records in jazz. It opens with an unaccompanied trumpet solo, a cadenza, that was as ear-catching in 1928 as it could possibly have been. There'd never been a more virtuosic piece of jazz playing, and it still catches the ear today.
All right, let's hear it. What That's Louis Armstrong with the Hot Five, West End Blues, 19... I guess Mr. Teachout, the book says 1928.
Yeah.
I think I had written down 1927.
Yeah, it's 1928.
Hey, what's a year among friends?
Looking up for jazz.
Oh, yes. And I like that. I wanted to particularly make sure that we played something that would be an early-ish, something really well known, and yet maybe something that for a lot of people, if what they knew was the Louis Armstrong of Hello Dolly, that this might be newer or surprising.
And this is the recording of Armstrong's that I talk about at the greatest length in the book. It really is the pivotal moment, the moment when he comes completely into focus as an artist, and the record that was immensely influential among other musicians. Everybody who heard this, it just knocked them flat.
And have it right that Armstrong was essentially the first person to do a lot of scat singing?
Yes, he's the first person to be well known for it. People did sing scat before he came along, but Armstrong made one of the first recordings of scat and the first one to become widely distributed. So he was the man for whom most people, from whom they heard it for the first time.
Yeah, just maybe one more question. We talked a little bit earlier about how he got his, when he was a boy, he got his first horn, a cornet, started by teaching himself. Then because he got into trouble, he went to reform school, and there he got formal instruction, so he learned to read music. Also, you talked about the fact that though that because his mouth position wasn't what it should be, he had a lot of lip problems later. Was he, technically speaking, was he an accomplished player?
He was one of the most accomplished trumpet players who ever lived. It's one thing to have a faulty embouchure that causes trouble for you. It's another thing to be, as he was, a completely natural player with a natural mechanism. He actually developed the upper register of the trumpet to a degree that classical musicians had not developed. And everybody who heard him starting in the mid-20s, no matter what you played, no matter what kind of music you liked, was staggered, especially by that upper register playing.
Yeah, playing high notes that previous to that, at least maybe some people who played the trumpet classically maybe played, but other people didn't.
Yeah, I mean, not only did he play up there above the staff, but he played expressively above the staff. It wasn't a trick, you know, where you just throw in a high note to show that you can. He could soar up there and make music, and that was the big thing that set him apart.
All right, we have another caller to talk with, someone listening in Elburn, which is up in the northwestern part of the state here, line 4. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
In the Ken Burns documentary, Lillian Armstrong came out really bad. I mean, she was portrayed as a leech. Instead of the musicianship that she had, in fact, just heard it, and her arranging for the group, which was completely ignored, and she came out badly, as did all the women musicians. I'd like you to if you can, what was your idea on Lillian Armstrong and her, what she did for Louis? And I'll get off the phone and listen on the radio.
Okay, thanks for the question.
Well, actually, Lil's not playing on this record. That's Earl Hines. She and Armstrong had essentially broken their musical ties late in 1927 before this record was made. But during the time that they were together, she played an immensely important role in his artistic development. Part of it was simply that she encouraged him to step away from being a supporting player for King Oliver, which is where they met in Oliver's Creole Jazz Band, and to present himself as a leader. It was in her band that he first established himself as a soloist. She was the leader of the band that played at the club in Chicago where he began to become well known. She was not a great jazz pianist, and I don't think she ever said she was. In fact, she said the opposite, that her understanding of jazz was superficial. But her schooling of Armstrong, she encouraged him actually to play what they called classical music together, and what I suspect was cornet solos by the great turn-of-the-century brass band players. It was very, very important in Armstrong's developing the kind of technical reach and self-confidence that made it possible for him to step forward and become the great player. They didn't get along personally after the first couple of years. He thought that she was a bit too high-flying for him. He talked about how every time he sat down on the bed after it had been made, she complained about it. They had a rather difficult marriage. They separated around 1928. They didn't divorce until 38, but they were not together after that, except for the odd occasion. But apparently she carried the torch for him, and for the rest of his life, he never, ever ceased to acknowledge her contribution to his development as an artist.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, Terry Teachout. He's a drama critic of the Wall Street Journal and is the author of a newly published biography of Louis Armstrong. The title of the book is Pops, and it is published by Houghton Mifflin. It's out on the bookstores now, and I'm sure that you'd recognize it right off because it has a nice portrait of the man on the cover. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. We've talked a little bit about his stage presence and about how important that was, and maybe indeed that was something that was honed by so much live performing. Where did that come from, and how did he develop that?
Well, he started playing in public as a boy, after he began playing professionally as soon as he got out of the Colored Waves home in New Orleans, and he became a full-time professional trumpet player in 1918, right at which time he was 17 years old, right when World War I ended. He never had another day job after that, and when he came to Chicago in 1922, that was the finishing school. He played for a couple of years in Oliver's band, went to New York, played with Fletcher Henderson's band. After that, he was always the leader. And he was playing in all kinds of musical settings, everything from his own band to a movie house orchestra, where he played classical music along with his featured numbers. It's not well known that Armstrong loved classical music, was very influenced by grand opera, as were many other jazz musicians in New Orleans, which had an opera culture. You can hear, actually, the impress of singers like Caruso and John McCormick, and he talks about this in the lyricism of his style.
Hmm. We have some other callers here. Well, let's talk with them. Somebody on a cell phone, line one. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
How are you?
Good.
Oh, thanks for answering my call. Fascinating program. We've come to really enjoy Louis Armstrong a lot more the last few years, just been buying CDs, reading, and visiting the home in the museum in Corona. I had a question, though, about his touring and his traveling. I live in central Illinois, in Champaign. I grew up in Decatur, Illinois. For many years, decades, there was a theater in Decatur known as the Lincoln Theater, and they often had vaudeville acts traveling in between Chicago and St. Louis, performing there. Do you, in your research, and is it obvious or not that he actually performed at that particular theater? And are there records of it?
Well, we're talking about somebody who played 300 nights a year. I don't remember
right.
That particular theater. He played all over Illinois, but then
okay.
He played all over America. I would not be surprised to hear that he played in any theater that presented acts like that between, say, 1929 when he hit the road and 1969 when he basically came off it because of illness. Alas, I can't tell you anything specific about that theater, but there's a lot of theaters out there.
Okay. Thank you very much.
All
my
right.
Pleasure.
Very good. Let's go on to another caller, Champaign County, line two. Hello.
Yeah, I have a lot of things as usual, but I thought I'd start it out by saying this kind of hot music is being played by a group called the Traditional Jazz Orchestra in town, so people like it. They can hear some people playing it locally. So
that's great.
There's a political dimension to Armstrong that he was sort of an ambassador for the USIA, and there are other people that were critical of him during the incipient civil rights era for not speaking out, though he did chide Eisenhower, if I recall.
He didn't just chide Eisenhower, he gave him both barrels full of rock salt. That was one of the most widely reported episodes in Armstrong's life, and a story that I tell in considerable detail and unexpurgated, I might add, in Pops.
Right. Well, it was highlighted by the fact that he hadn't spoken out before, and
no.
This may sound a little bit this is the era of J. Edgar Hoover and people having files on them. Part of Armstrong's prodigious appetite included included smoking cigar-sized marijuana cigarettes.
I think he was a daily communicant of the Church of Marijuana.
And his place in New Jersey, the other person just referred to, is tricked out like somebody's some pothead's a fantasist, I understand, with mirrors and colors and bright. And so, and that was before the 60s, actually. So,
right.
But I thought that they probably had something on him and were suppressing his...
No, actually not. Armstrong's FBI file is accessible, and it's quite innocuous. The State Department, I assume, was aware that he used marijuana. They would have been. It didn't stop them from asking him to become an informal ambassador performing under their auspices. The file itself is of no interest because Armstrong did not engage in any kind of political activity. He was a completely apolitical man. He didn't even vote. And so it was highly uncharacteristic of him to speak out in the way he did in public about Eisenhower and the Little Rock desegregation crisis. In private, it was a different matter. And when you read Pops, you will see that on the private tapes that I have listened to, he speaks with extraordinary frankness and bluntness about race relations and civil rights. He simply didn't see that this was his job as an entertainer. He really didn't. To the extent that he embodies a vision of black possibility, it's in a more personal way. There's a wonderful story. W.C. Handy, who wrote St. Louis Blues, saw him on stage actually playing in an all-black movie house in Chicago in 1926 or 27, before an all-black audience. And Handy recalled years later, he said that what he saw up there on the stage was the pride of race. That was Armstrong's symbolic contribution, that he was a black genius. Among many other things, he was the first black man ever to receive star billing in a Hollywood movie, the first black to host a radio variety series of his own. These contributions and his offstage contributions in insisting that he be allowed to stay at hotels where he played, things like that, in the 30s and 40s and the early 50s, those were not small things. The Eisenhower story is a fascinating one. Armstrong was playing, I think, in Grand Rapids, and a Cub reporter came to interview him. And this was shortly after Eisenhower had balked about doing anything about desegregating the public schools in Little Rock. And the Cub reporter asked him about this, and Armstrong exploded and described Eisenhower and Orville Faubus, the governor of Arkansas, and John Foster Dulles, the Secretary of State, in language that I cannot even begin to use on this show. And cleaned up, this became the biggest story in the United States the next day. And a few days later, Eisenhower sent the National Guard into Little Rock. So Armstrong may not have been a political activist in terms of being somebody who marched and carried signs, but in terms of his effect on American culture, he was an enormously significant figure.
I'm not entirely confident the FBI would have registered the fact that they were muscling somebody in their FBI report. The other thing, I'm just curious, am I confusing you with a Terry Teachout who used to write here in Champaign-Urbana?
I went to the university for a couple of years.
I remember you writing for the Orange and Blue Observer.
Many years ago. Disagreeing
with you then, as I probably do on your political views.
No, it was just...
Thanks
it was
a lot
just
for
a,
writing the book, anyway.
It was just a fly-through. I went from there to New York.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is indeed Terry Teachout. He's the author of a new biography of Louis Armstrong. The title of the book is Pops. He's a drama critic for the Wall Street Journal, chief culture critic of commentary, author of biographies of George Balanchine and H.L. Mencken. And we're talking here about Armstrong, and we'll play some more music here in a bit. I do have another caller here, so we'll bring him in. We'll go to Chicago for the next line four. Hello.
Thank you. Could you comment on some of the other personal aspects of Louis, such as his religious affiliation or interest? And I have a follow-up question.
Sure. He was baptized Catholic, but he was not aware of that. As far as I know, he didn't even know that the baptism had taken place. Grew up attending probably a Baptist church when he was a boy. He didn't go to a church as an adult, but was a regular Bible reader. I think a fairly serious believer. But organized religion was not a regular part of his life.
Well, in contrast to that, I know he had a personal relationship with Dizzy, and a comment about Dizzy having belonged to the Baha'i faith. and expounding on every public occasion. I was just wondering what Louis.
The caller's referring to Dizzy Gillespie, and as far as I know, Armstrong never had anything to say about that.
Well, one more comment between the two. I know at some point there was a kind of a difference on different aspects, one regarding the other as being.
Right. Well, that's a long, complicated story told in detail in the book, and an important one. After World War II, when bebop came along, the bebop musicians saw themselves not like Armstrong as artist entertainers, but as people who wanted to present themselves as artists and be treated as artists. And they saw Armstrong's outgoing stage demeanor as something that made them uncomfortable. Gillespie talked about it very explicitly with the media. He called Armstrong's behavior subservient. Armstrong, in return, enraged by this comment, went after the beboppers on various grounds, mainly that he thought their music was so complicated that it alienated audiences. On the other hand, they both really respected each other's trumpet playing, and they made it up completely. They actually appeared on television together in 1958, and they were friends. And at the end of Gillespie's life, when he wrote his autobiography, he took it all back. He said that he had misunderstood Armstrong, that he, Gillespie, had, and this is his phrase, his own way of timing. Gillespie was himself very much an entertainer, the clown prince of bebop. So the differences that they had in the early 50s eventually were put behind both of them.
Okay. Again, I want to thank the caller. Go on to somebody here on line number one, and I believe that is someone in Champaign. Hello.
Yeah, hi.
Yeah.
In terms of the title, wasn't there one in terms of black and tan or something rather that he played, or what, am I not correct on that?
I'm sorry, I don't quite get
the black. Are you asking about? As a matter of fact, I was going to play some of that. You're talking about the Black and Tan Fantasy.
Yeah.
That piece.
You know, because an earlier caller, in terms of saying he's not political in the whole bit, race was certainly an issue with him, but I think it was reflected in terms of this music.
Yes, of course. I mean, race. This was not a man who had any illusions about the conditions of blacks in America, because he'd had his nose rubbed in it from childhood onward. But there's a difference between feeling strongly about these things and presenting yourself as a political activist, and that was something that Armstrong did not do. He didn't. It was his job.
He was also very good to, I read someplace, in terms of the people on their way up, in terms of in jazz.
Oh, he was incredibly generous. I mean, not just to fellow musicians, but to everybody. He gave away a couple of $1,000 in pocket money every week of his adult life once he started making money. And as far as giving a hand to young musicians, there simply couldn't have been a more generous man, a more caring man. And yes, by the way, he did record Duke Ellington's Black and Tan Fantasy with Ellington at the piano. It's one of the great records of his late middle age.
Well, there, that gives us a good reason to play it, because one of the things that people will find in the book is your list of 30 key recordings. And,
yes, all of which can be downloaded from iTunes.
So there's no question that if people want to hear the music, it's possible to do it. And that was one that I picked. In fact, that is one that's out of my own collection, that Duke Ellington, Louis Armstrong, Duke Ellington CD.
Hey, you've got a good shelf.
I don't know about that, but that's there. This was, and I wanted to play this because it was one of the latest recordings on your list. This is 1961. I don't know that we'd be able to play the whole thing, but I wanted to have people hear some of this. Oh. And again, before we play it, is there anything you'd want to say about it?
Well, this is a song that Ellington composed in 1926, became one of his great anthems. And when he and Armstrong came to make a record together, Armstrong played it with a force and directness that you really wouldn't expect from a man who had actually turned 60 the year that the record was made. It is one of his great, great classics.
All right, let's hear it.
Thank you.
Is a Black and Tan Fantasy. It's a Duke Ellington composition. Duke Ellington at the piano and playing the trumpet, Louis Armstrong. And again, just our guest this morning in this part of Focus 580 is Terry Teachout. He's the author of a new biography of Louis Armstrong. The title of the book is Pops. It's published by Houghton Mifflin. And that is one of the pieces that's on his list that's in the book of essential recordings. Anything more that you might want to say about that?
The riff that he plays at the end of his solo in the middle of the piece actually is one that he learned from King Oliver as a boy. The Oliver Creole jazz band, you can hear him playing that riff on Jazz and Baby Blues. And a few years later, in 1928, Armstrong uses it as the climax of his solo on one of his famous Hot 5 records, Muggles. And then years later, he pulls it out of his memory and uses it as the climax of his solo in Black and Tan Fantasy.
Yeah, that's a great record, and I decided I just want to play the whole thing. I so hate to start playing something and then have to fade out of it. So I thought,
I'm glad you did. I never get tired of listening to that
whole thing. And following that, I hate to say something negative, but I guess I wonder what you would say, and maybe what he said, about people who said something like, "Well, you know, he certainly was brilliant. He was a great trumpet player, but that his style was solidified early, and that it never progressed. I mean, it never went beyond that."
Well, I imagine he would have said, how could you go beyond what I did? Remember, this is a man who changed the whole language of jazz in the late 20s. Max Harrison, the great British jazz critic, actually talks about this, and I quote him in Pops because I think it's exactly to the point. Harrison said that Armstrong spent the first part of his career carving out new territory, and the second half of it exploring it. And I think that's exactly right. He didn't need to innovate after the early 30s. He had attained the language that he wanted, and then he learned how to use it. So he didn't play greatly differently in the second half of his life, except to simplify and streamline his utterances in the way that middle-aged artists do, the same way that, you know, Matisse changed. We didn't need to have Armstrong playing bebop, although he could have. He actually experiments a bit with it in the mid-40s. The point was that he being a great artist, we want to hear what he wants to say. That's how I feel about it.
Yeah. All right. We have about 5 minutes left. Let's take another call. Someone in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Yeah, hi. I was always heard, and I've always wondered, I can't wait to read your book and find out, if there was any truth to the fact that Louis was the first entertainer to ever own his own plane, and then the reasoning behind that.
To own his own plane? Did I hear that right?
Yeah, I think that's what the caller was saying.
What do you mean? Help me out a little.
Well, I heard that he was the first entertainer that would fly around in his own private plane.
Oh, his plane.
We're talking about airplane.
No,
right.
He definitely didn't do that. What he did do in the 30s was he would use a private Pullman car to tour the Deep South with his band because the band was black and, you know, they didn't have any place to stay. So instead of holing up in those terrible wrong side of the tracks boarding houses, they would attach a private Pullman car to the train and they'd sleep on it. They would be safer there as well as having better circumstances. But no, he didn't have a private plane.
Okay.
All right.
That's great.
Okay, well, and then let's go back here to quickly to Chicago. Hello, line four. Go ahead.
You referred to King Oliver and Louis and sort of talking about a lineage between all the different other trumpet players and so forth. And to follow through on that point, Dizzy made a remark about Louis. He says, "No he, no me." So I thought I'd put that in there for the personal relationship they had. And then one more comment. When they went out together, the story goes that they got there and had a lady friend's house, and she said, "Oh, well, so nice to have him there." And she said, "Would you like some tea?" And Louis says, "Well, sure." And you know the story. When she served it, he said, "What's that?" Oh, I thought, okay, goodbye.
That's funny. I hadn't heard that one.
Would you like some tea? Of course.
He didn't usually take it in a glass.
There's so many things about him that make him really important in the history of American popular music. And I think one of the things I want to make sure we talk about is that he was a very early example of what, maybe later, I don't know when we started using this word, but later came to be called crossover.
Yes.
That is, he made records that were intended for a black audience, but they were also sold to a wide audience too, and so there was clearly they saw that potential for his playing to and selling to both audiences.
Right. It starts as early as 1928. West End Blues was the first Armstrong record that was marketed not just as what was back then called a race record, but was also sold in record stores in white neighborhoods. And the fact that Armstrong crossed over so early to a general audience is one of the most significant things about him as a historical figure, because jazz in his person, the real, true, authentic jazz, was made available to everyone, first in America and then to the whole world. Without him, jazz might not have achieved the kind of cultural reach that it finally developed.
Yeah. Earlier on, we talked about the fact that you had access to some materials that previous writers didn't, and that was this enormous body of tape recordings that he made, these hundreds of recordings. He was one of the first person to have a consumer-level tape recorder at a time when not very many people did, and as you explained, that he got it because he wanted to tape performances and listen back to them. But then what he started to do is record everything, record his life, record conversations with friends. There is in the book this reference to one time late at night in a hotel room, the tape recorder was rolling, and he was trying to convince his wife to go to bed with him.
It's absolutely true.
And then that she when she realized that was going on, she told him, again using language that we can't use on the radio, said, "Turn that off, wipe that out, get rid of that thing." Is there something particularly from that you wouldn't otherwise get?
I'll tell you the story. To her insistence that he erase the tape, he said, "I can't do that. This is for posterity." And 50 years later, I was sitting with a pair of headphones in the Armstrong archives listening to this tape. And he says that, and I started laughing out loud because I realized I'm posterity.
That was you. You were posterity.
Yeah. The serious point is that Armstrong understood what he was, that he was a historical figure. He wasn't self-conscious about it. He would never have called himself a genius, but he knew that he had a place in the history of American art and culture, and that's why he kept these tapes, because he understood that someday some guy would come along who would want to listen to them and draw on them to write a truly accurate and honest history of his life, right down to this wonderfully funny tape of Louis and Lucille having it out at 5 in the morning in a hotel room.
And he apparently was a writer and was quite a good writer.
He was a very good writer. He had completely untutored, of course, but he had the essential gift of getting his own voice onto the page. And Satchmo, My Life in New Orleans, his autobiography, is, I think, the best book ever written by a jazz musician. You can absolutely hear him, and there's no ghostwriter. He wrote it without assistance.
Well, we're just about at the point where we're going to have to finish. People, as I said, could take a look at the book. They can look at your list of essential recordings, which you've said you can download. They're all available from iTunes, so they're there. I'm sure people can go to a record store. They can go to the library. Lots and lots of work out there. They can hear him, hear the music. Any last sort of thing you'd like to leave with folks?
I can just tell you that after working for 5 years on this book, I never got tired of him, never felt disillusioned with him. He's that great rarity, a great man, a great artist who improves with exposure. And I hope that that's something that you feel as you read my book.
Yeah. Our guest this morning, Terry Teachout, he's the drama critic of the Wall Street Journal. He's the author of a new biography of Louis Armstrong. The title of the book is Pops and is published by Houghton Mifflin. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Oh, what a pleasure. Thanks for having me.